we were talking about accelerating the convergence of convergent series. But this is, I think, a lot more interesting. This topic involves, as I say, summing of divergent series. I want to go back, as soon as they can scan some transparencies, I want to go back and continue talking a little bit about why it is that perturbation theory in quantum mechanics or quantum field theory diverges. That is, the underlying fundamental reason for it, namely, what are the singularities in the complex plane. But what I'm going to be talking about here is summing of divergent series. And these are some examples of series that are divergent. Okay. Now, this top series is an interesting series, very simple-looking series. It is a divergent series, even though the terms in the series are not getting big. Okay? So the terms, let's get some notation down. So we are talking about a series of the form A sub n. And as you can see, it's not necessary for these terms A sub n to get big for the series to diverge. What you mean by a convergent series is simply that the partial sum, sum from n equals 0 to capital N of A sub n, what you mean by convergent is simply that the partial sum converges to a limit, okay? And we'll call that limit the sum of the series, okay? As this is as n goes to infinity, that's what you mean by the sum of a series, okay? The convergence of a series. And it's clear that the partial sums of this series do not converge. They simply oscillate, okay? Here's a series that is very rapidly divergent, diverges obviously like 2 to the n. And we're going to see that there is an unambiguous sum of this series. By the way, this series, in case you want to know, converges to the value 1/2. Okay, and you can sort of see that because the partial sums are alternating between 1 and 0. So in some sense, you could understand why this series, we're going to show this series converges to 1/2. This series, it's not at all obvious what it converges to, but it converges to minus 1. Okay? This series is obviously a divergent series, 1 plus 1 plus 1. Okay? And this guy, can you guess what the limit of, what the limit of S sub n is in this case? What does this series converge to? Infinity. You're right. And there's nothing wrong for us. I mean, this series, converges to minus 1. Okay? But there's nothing wrong with the series converging to infinity. And in fact, that's absolutely correct. This series is infinity. This series is particularly interesting because if you were to do, if the associative principle in arithmetic held true, zero, what difference does it make to add zero to a series? Okay, zero, nothing, right? So if you remove the zeros, if you simply add them, if you use the associative principle in arithmetic and add the zero to the one that's standing to the left of it, this series obviously becomes that series. However, the sum of this series is not 1/2, as you will see. Not at all 1/2. And that's because the associative principle in arithmetic is not valid. Okay? If it were, by the way, if you could use associativity in arithmetic, then you could add these terms in pairs and get 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0, okay, which, and the sum of that series would be 0. So commutivity, associativity, all of those arithmetic laws that you've heard of are perfectly nice laws so long as you only use them a finite number of times. But if you use them an infinite number of times, you're very likely to get a wrong answer. Okay? So here is the bottom line. I want to give you the bottom line first. The bottom line of what we're going to be talking about this week is that divergent series are not bad. In fact, they are useful. And in fact, they converge faster than convergent series. They get to the answer much, much faster. Okay. So what I want to, and of course, this is the example I talked about last time. This is the example of the anharmonic oscillator. We found a series expansion. I mean, those were just numerical examples, mathematical examples. But this is a good physical example. And we found the series expansion for the ground state eigenvalue. Here are the first three coefficients in that series. And this is an example of a divergent series. And you can see that this, well, as I told you last time, this series diverges for all values of epsilon. We might, in particular, be interested in summing the series at epsilon equals 1. And that's an example of a rapidly divergent series, where the nth term in the series grows like n factorial. And we're going to learn how to sum all of these series, OK? By the way, this is another example of a divergent series, the series 1 plus a half plus a third plus a quarter plus a fifth, and so on. This is zeta of 1. This is another example of a series that is divergent. It is not convergent. This series adds up to infinity. And this is very, very good if you're interested in things like architecture. Okay, architecture, you say. What's the relevance of architecture? So let me ask you a question. Suppose you wanted to build, you were an architect, and you wanted to build a bridge. The question is, if you ran out of concrete, and all you had was bricks, and let's suppose that your brick looked like this, okay? Let's suppose that this brick is 2 units long, just for fun. The question is, if you wanted to build a bridge by piling bricks on top of one another, like this, okay? Question is, how big, if you didn't have concrete and you could only just pile one brick on top of another, how big an overhang can you make? How far can your bridge go out before it falls down? Do you know? Well, let's see if we can build a bridge, OK? What you do to build a bridge is you pile the bricks on top of one another in such a way that they don't fall over, OK? Well, if I pile this brick directly on top of another brick so that the center of mass, the center of mass of this brick is the dotted line, then I can have an overhang of 1 unit before the bridge falls over. So I'm allowed to have an overhang of just 1 unit. OK, now let's look at this pair of bricks. This pair of bricks has a center of mass that is right over here. OK, and the center of mass of this brick is exactly 1/2 unit away from the right side of this brick, right? And therefore, I can pile this on top of another brick, OK? And the center of mass of these three bricks is exactly 1/3 of a way from that side of the brick. And therefore, I can pile this on top of another brick without it falling off. Okay. And the center of mass of this is 1/4 of the way from the right-hand side of this brick, and so on. So the total overhang is actually 1 plus a half plus a third plus a fourth, and so on. So in fact, when I get done piling bricks on top of bricks all the way down, the total overhang here is actually infinite. And it doesn't fall down. Okay, it's quite remarkable. Of course, you can't stand on this bridge. But it's a really nice, it's a really nice piece of decoration. Okay, so Here's what I'm talking about. Here's the center of mass. Here's the overhang. Here's two bricks. The center of mass is over here. So therefore, I now have an overhang of 1 plus 0.5, and so on. Okay, and it's pretty clear that I can make a bridge with an infinite overhang. Okay, pretty impressive without using any arch, no concrete, just mathematics. Okay, of course, you do understand that you have to build the bridge from the top down. This isn't so easy, so you have to have a helicopter that's very strong, that can hold a lot of bricks. And okay. So what are the techniques for summing series? The techniques for summing series are as follows. I'm going to emphasize that addition, to begin with, is not infinitely commutative. So I guess the story I should tell you is this. When I was a little kid, I was learning, I was early in junior high school or something. My teacher decided to teach us modern mathematics, new mathematics, or something like this. And I remember my teacher said, now I'm going to tell you about the arithmetical system that we've been studying. And I said, oh, good, this sounds great. She said, there are three properties of arithmetic. The first property is that arithmetic is commutative. And my teacher said, commutative means that A plus B equals B plus A. And I said, that's obvious. Why do we need a word for it? That's just like naming one of the animals in the zoo. I haven't learned anything. I've just learned a name for something that I already knew to be true. Okay? But this was apparently a very important fact about arithmetic. Well, in fact, arithmetic is not commutative. At least, it's not infinitely commutative. So this is actually not true in general. Okay? And then I learned the associative law. And the associative law said something like A plus B is equal to B plus A. Let's make this capital associative. Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. A plus B plus C is equal to A plus B plus C, except that I can add in different orders. Okay. This law is also not true. This is false in general. It's not arithmetic is not infinitely commutative. Then we learned that arithmetic was distributive, that A times B plus C is equal to AB plus AC. That's great. This is a really good law. And this holds true in general. And that's because we would like arithmetic to be, this is just, you know, distributive is a very fancy word for linear. Okay, this is just linearity. And this is true, and this is a really great law. Okay, so of the three laws, you're going to see that only one of them survive, which is very interesting. Okay. And I guess the lesson is that you should never teach anything to kids unless you give a counterexample. Because what's the meaning of commutative or associative unless you show me something that isn't commutative or associative? That's the only way I think that someone can learn something. Okay, so let me show you that addition is not infinitely commutative. Okay, and it's a very easy demonstration. You know that the sum of the series 1 minus a half plus a third minus a fourth plus a fifth, and so on, you know that this series adds up to what? Log 2, okay. Log 2, all right. So this is what this statement, this is a very subtle statement, okay? Because this is not an absolutely convergent series. This is a conditionally convergent series. And when you say it adds up to log of 2, this is what you mean. You mean that if you take the sequence S1 equals 1, and S2 equals 1 minus 1 half,
and S3 equals 1 minus 1 half plus 1 third, and so on,
okay,
then Sn will indeed converge to log of 2 as n goes to infinity.
That's a true statement, okay? That's correct. But arithmetic is not infinitely commutative. So in fact, if I use the commutative law, I can make this series add up to anything I like. Anything. Okay? So suppose, for example, that you prefer this series to add up to pi, for example. We can make this series add up to pi, no problem, just by using commutivity. Okay? So how do you do that? So you take all of the positive terms in the series and you put them in a box. Here are all the positive terms. In descending order, okay, you notice this series has a bunch of terms that are monotone decreasing. So I can put all of the terms in one set, one box, in descending order. And I can put all the negative terms, in another box in descending order, in magnitude. Okay? Now, how do we make the series add up to pi? The rule is quite simple. You continue to take positive terms, p1, p2, p3, and so on. You continue to add them, taking them in this order, from largest to smallest, okay, from this box, until the partial sum is greater than pi. Okay? Now that we've exceeded the number pi, we start taking negative terms, so n1, n2, and so on. This is a finite thing, p4, and then it stops. Okay? Then we start taking the negative terms in the series, n1, n2, n3, and so on, until it gets to be less than pi. Okay? Then we take some more positive terms, p5, p6, p7, okay, until it is greater than pi. And then we take some more negative terms, n4, n5, until it is less than pi. And we continue that process. Okay? Now, you understand that these partial sums will oscillate above pi, and then below pi, and just above pi, and just below pi. And the partial sums in this series will oscillate above, below, in smaller and smaller oscillations. Why will the oscillations get smaller? Because we have ordered the terms in the series in descending magnitude. Okay? So this new series, okay, when we look at the partial sums, it will oscillate above and below pi with smaller and smaller oscillations, and eventually it will converge to pi. And furthermore, we will have used all of the numbers in that series. We have merely commuted them. We've added them up in different order. Okay? So arithmetic is definitely not commutative. Okay? Addition is definitely not commutative. So when is it commutative? It is commutative if the series is absolutely convergent. Okay? So we're using the fact that this series is only conditionally convergent, and that partial if you take subseries out of this, subsequences out of these numbers, you can get a divergent series. It is because of this that the series can be made to converge to anything. The point is, you might worry that once I've gone below pi, there aren't enough positive terms to take me back above pi. But that will not be the case. That's because all the positive terms in this series add up to infinity. Okay? So we have to remember that arithmetic, for example, that addition, is not infinitely commutative. All right. So now let me show you something very, very nice, very elegant. Okay, so this is the question. Is it possible to sum a divergent series and in a meaningful way get a finite number for the sum of the series? Is this even faintly conceivable? Okay. Now, so what I want to talk to you about first is Euler summation. How do you, so let's assume that we have here a series, sum of a sub n. And let's suppose this series is not a convergent series. Is it possible to sum this series and get a finite sum for the series? Okay, so is it possible in some sensible way to define a finite sum for the series, even if the series is a divergent series, in the usual sense of the meaning? Okay, so Euler proposed a way to do it. And this is what Euler said. So let me see if I can make absolutely clear what I'm saying. When we talked about the Shanks transformation, or about Richardson extrapolation, what did we do? We said that given a series of this type, it doesn't make sense just to add up the numbers in order. Even though there's a sum sign in front of these numbers, adding them up, just starting with the first number, a1, a2, a3, just adding them up is not a sensible thing to do. So we invented various machines. Okay, so we invented a summation machine. We can call that M. Okay, and you put in the numbers a1, a2, a3, and this is some procedure that extracts the sum from these numbers. It doesn't do it in the obvious way, just by adding them up in order, but there is some function here. There's some process for taking these numbers and assigning and pulling out the sum of the series in a very efficient way. So this is what we're going to do for a divergent series as well. We're going to invent a machine. Okay. So Mr. Euler, who was a relatively clever person, suggested the following idea. He said, suppose this series is divergent. But suppose the series a sub n x to the n, sum from 0 to infinity, suppose this series is convergent for x less than 1. Okay? So just suppose that happens to be true. It might be true. Okay? Then we define, and that's the key word here, we define the sum of the series to be as follows. Since this is convergent, we will call this the function f of x. That is, we will sum this series, which gives us a function f of x, and then we'll define the sum of the series to be the limit as x approaches 1 from below. Okay, we'll have to be very careful. We'll let x approach 1 from below of f of x. And then, of course, there's a caveat. And the caveat is, if it exists. Okay? So we'll define that to be the limit of the, we'll define this limit to be the sum of the series. Okay, that's just a definition. Okay? Now, of course, I know what you're thinking. You'll say, yeah, but this is completely artificial. I mean, it might work, it might not work, but if it does work, what's the meaning of that? Okay, but let me just convince you that in some cases it works. Okay, so let's, for example, take the series 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 1 and so on. Okay, so this series is a simple example of a divergent series. So what does Mr. Euler say? Mr. Euler says, consider instead the series 1 minus x plus x squared minus x cubed plus x to the fourth. And he says, add up this series if we can do so. Let's assume that the series does converge for x in absolute value less than 1. This series does converge, okay? And the sum of this series
which is this function f of x, is 1 over 1 plus x.
And then he says, we recover the original series as the boundary of this series. Okay?
So the sum of the series would be the limit as x approaches 1 of 1 over 1 plus x, which is 1 half.
Okay? And that's why I said before that the sum of this series is 1 half. Okay, now I know what you're thinking. You're thinking this is kind of trivial. And furthermore, you're thinking it could be that, well, you're thinking several things. First of all, the limit might not exist. And in many cases, it clearly won't exist. But you just invented an ad hoc machine that could produce a finite answer instead of a non-existent answer. Okay, this is very ad hoc. Okay, so feel free to criticize Mr. Euler. So let's try another technique, which happens to be a more powerful technique. Let's try Borel summation. Okay? So along comes another guy, maybe not quite as clever as Mr. Euler, but very, very clever guy. And we'll try Borel summation. So how does Borel summation work? Well, we start in exactly the same way. We have a series of the form a sub n. And this series is a divergent series. Okay? And it may be quite rapidly divergent. And what Mr. Borel says is the following. He says, let's insert into this series, we'll change every term in this series by multiplying every term in the series by, let's write it again, every term in the series by 1. You wouldn't object to that, he says. No reason to object to multiplying every single term in the series by 1. Okay? But, he says, an interesting way to write the number 1 is as follows. 1 is equal to the integral from 0 to infinity, e to the minus t, t to the n, dt, over n factorial. Okay, that's a very interesting way to write the number 1. By the way, I hope you all agree that this is 1. Okay, if you were given the integral in the numerator here, how would you evaluate this integral? Of course, you would use integration by parts, right? Right, of course. Okay. So if you differentiate t to the n and you integrate e to the minus t, every time you do an integration by parts, you pull down a factor of n and then a factor of n minus 1, n minus 2, n minus 3, which gives you the n factorial in the denominator. It all cancels, and the answer is 1. Okay? So this is just a simple way to represent n factorial. So Mr. Borel says, in this case, we can write the series without changing it into the form a sub n times the integral from 0 to infinity dt e to the minus t, t to the n, divided by n factorial. So we haven't changed the series that we're trying to sum. But now, Mr. Borel says, let's do something that you might think is a little bit sleazy. What am I going to do?
Move the a n inside the integral?
Move the integral outside of the sum. I think that's roughly the same. So the point is, here we are doing an integral term by term. Okay, but what we're going to do is to move the integral outside of the summation. We're going to interchange orders of integration and summation. Now, in fact, I don't know if you know any asymptotics or if you've ever learned any asymptotics. How many of you have heard of Watson's lemma? That's a good thing I'm here, actually, that's in general. Okay, so Watson's lemma actually proceeds in the opposite direction. When you expand a function that is represented by an integral into an asymptotic series, one of the standard techniques is called Watson's lemma. Okay? And it actually is the inverse, or the reverse, of Borel's summation. So, in other words, what Mr. Borel says is, let's interchange orders of summation and integration, and we will do that by fiat. That is, we will not ask, is this a valid procedure? We will simply do it as part of our machine. Okay? So we will then say, this is the integral from 0 to infinity, dt e to the minus t, times the sum of a sub n over n factorial times t to the n. Okay? Yeah.
Then you can regard integral as some integration like summation. So if you interchange, you are presuming that addition is commutative before we do it.
Not at all. Absolutely not. We are not using any commutivity here. Absolutely not. What we are using is the distributive law. I have factored out the e to the minus t from every term. Okay, that's the distributive rule, and addition is infinitely distributive, but I have absolutely not commuted anything. I have not interchanged the order of adding up terms in the series. I absolutely will not do that, because that would be wrong. Okay? So now I have a sum from 0 to infinity, and what he says is, let us suppose that this summation actually exists. We could call, when we perform this sum, we could call this function g of x or g of t or something like that. It doesn't matter. And then we will define, this is a definition, okay? Hang on, just one second. So this is a definition, and we will define the sum of the series to be e to the minus t times g of t. This is a definition. Okay, we're not worried about the validity of doing what we did. It is simply a way of defining the sum of the series. Okay, now let me lift this up here. Okay, so that was simply a definition. We're not discussing whether this was valid or invalid, or more importantly, significant or insignificant. It was merely a procedure. Yeah?
These techniques work for series that do converge?
That is a very important question, and the answer is yes. Okay? And it is clear that it works if the series is convergent, because it doesn't matter which order I do anything in. In other words, performing this calculation for series that does converge, there's absolutely no problem here. Okay? We can work some examples and then illustrate that. But of course, the most important, I mean, this definition, Euler summation E, or Borel summation B, would be meaningless if it gave a different sum to a series that was convergent. But in fact, it always gives, you're going to see why in just a second. By the way, I will show you in just a moment why it is that it works, of course, if the series is convergent. Okay, I will show you that. Okay, so let me give you some examples of the use of Borel summation. Okay, let's take, now I want you to observe that there's an n factorial in the denominator here. This can help a rapidly divergent series to converge. So what's a rapidly divergent series? Well, consider the series sum from n equals 0 to infinity minus 1 to the n times n factorial. Whew. That is a rapidly divergent series. This is an awful series. Okay? And this is getting very, very close to the physical problem that we have in mind, namely finding the energy levels of the anharmonic oscillator. This is an important example because it's getting very, very close now to quantum mechanics. Okay? And by the way, Euler summation is powerless. Because what would Mr. Euler say? Okay? He would say, consider instead minus 1 to the n, n factorial times x to the n. And he would say, if this converges for small enough x, we sum the series, and then we let x approach 1 to recover the original series. Well, the series doesn't converge for any x except x equals 0. So this doesn't work. Euler's machine is not powerful enough to sum that series. Let's look at Borel's machine, okay? So what Mr. Borel says is, consider the integral e to the minus t dt times the sum of minus 1 to the n over n factorial, okay, but times n factorial, okay, times t to the n. And then he says, aha, look, the n factorials cancel, and I know what this sum is. This sum is just 1 over 1 plus t. And therefore, Mr. Borel says that the Borel sum of the series is the integral from 0 to infinity e to the minus t dt over 1 plus t. And that integral exists. And therefore, Mr. Borel has summed the series. Or to put it more precisely, he has defined, he has given you a machine that can convert the original divergence series into a number that exists. You see, this integral exists. Okay. By the way, you can't evaluate this integral in, there's no simple formula for evaluating this integral, but the integral exists numerically, and what I claim, what I'm going to show you soon, is that this sum is actually the meaningful and unique sum of that series. Okay, that is the answer. Okay. Now, here is the interesting part. Okay, what I showed you was two machines, Euler summation and Borel summation. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking you can invent a third machine and a fourth machine and a fifth machine, and you can continue inventing machines for summing series, and they might give the same answer and they might give a different answer. And so, big deal, this is just art. This has nothing to do with mathematics or reality. You're just finding a way to take a divergent series and to assign a number that you're going to call the sum of the series. Big deal. Okay? So let's try something interesting. Let's ask, what happens if you try to calculate the Borel sum of 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 1? Like that. What is the Borel sum of that series? Okay, it's a good question, seems to me. Okay, well, Mr. Borel would say the sum of this series is the integral from 0 to infinity, dt e to the minus t times the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, 1, right, that the nth term in the series is just 1, or minus 1, to the n, over n factorial times t to the n, okay? Which is the integral from 0 to infinity dt e to the minus t times e to the minus t. And the integral of e to the minus 2t is 1/2, the same answer that we got from Euler's summation. So the question is there something more to this? I mean, am I just joking around? Or are we doing something meaningful here? OK. So to answer that question, so you understand what I'm saying here. Are these procedures of inventing summation machines going to lead anywhere? Or is this a joke? Yeah.
I'm kind of clear what he did on the left over there, because I mean, we know that t has to be less than 1, but he's integrating from t equals 0 to t equals infinity.
That's right. So what Mr. Borel says is, sum the series for small enough t. Okay. So he says this series here is a representation of some function g of t for sufficiently small t. This is a Taylor series. It's a representation for sufficiently small t in some circle of convergence. In this case, the circle of convergence happens to have a radius of 1. Then he says, extend this function analytically by analytic continuation. Okay, so you understand, the function g of t exists. The representation for that function, only the Taylor series representation, only exists inside of a circle of radius 1. But Once we sum the series, we can analytically continue that function to the entire real axis. In other words, where does the function reside? This is merely a representation of the function. That's the function. And that function has its own region of existence, and it exists on the entire real axis. Okay. If it didn't exist on the entire real axis, then the Borel sum would not exist. Which, by the way, does not mean that the sum of the series does not exist. It merely means that the Borel technique of finding the sum of the series didn't work. Okay, so can we speak in more general terms? Okay, so here's how I would try to explain it. Rather than inventing specific summation machines like the Euler technique or the Borel technique, let's try to devise a generic summation machine, okay, M. That's a summation machine, okay, for summing a series. And this machine takes as input A0, A1, A2, okay, dot, dot, dot. And there is some complicated procedure that we haven't yet defined, okay? And what it does is it, when it chews up all those numbers, grumble, 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 and from all those numbers, it assigns a sum of the series, okay, called S. Okay? Now, the question is, what properties must this machine have, the summation machine have? And I claim it must have exactly two properties. So, in fact, we can even call them axioms. The axiom of summation, what are the axioms of summation? So axiom number one is the statement, is the answer to the question that you asked before. Okay, so now we're going to address your question. The statement number one is, it has to act like a sum. I mean, it's some, you know, we're summing up the terms of a series. It has to behave as if you're doing addition. So what do I mean by that? What do I mean by that? We know that if we add up an infinite number of terms, the answer might not exist. Or it might take forever to get there. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to require that if you take the sum, if you apply your machine to the numbers A0, A1, A2, and so on, this series, okay, or let me write it this way. If we will apply the machine to the series sum of AN, okay, it has to be equal to what you get if you take off the first term from the series and then apply your machine to the remaining terms in the series. Therefore, but just by axiom one, my summation machine will do nothing but add up a series if the series is convergent. That is, so what does it mean by the series is convergent? It means that I can apply axiom one over and over and over again and recover the sum of a series if the series can just be added up. That's what I'm trying to incorporate into axiom number one. Yeah?
You will need the fact that m of something small.
It is small. That's right. In particular, m of 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0
yes,
plus is 0.
Mm-hmm. M of
the remainder, that's right. That's right. That's right. So I am in, so it will be small if the series is a convergent series. It will not be small if the series is a divergent series. This remainder term may be very, very big. But if the series is convergent, we want this remainder to be small. But of course, that's just a special case, okay? That is, if I write down a series, the chance of it being convergent is zero.
Yes.
Okay? But in that small chance, that is, we're trying to, the point is, this is an attempt to make my summation machine look like it's doing summation. And this is the only way I can express that. The only way I can express it, I can't add up the remainder of the series. I can only add up the first n terms in the series. And this is the only way I can express that.
But the point is that you haven't expressed it.
No.
Completely.
I understand what you're saying. The point is that if the series is divergent, we don't know what this is. It's this that has to be small. It's m of this that has to be small. Not this. This can be big, but this has to be small. And I agree with you. That has to be true. Okay? Otherwise, this procedure will not work. Okay? And by the way, it isn't always small. Because as I showed you before, there are some series that really honestly add up to infinity. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a perfectly good answer for summing a series. Perfectly wonderful. Okay? Okay, but this is going to be one of our two axioms that we will demand of any summation machine. And by the way, these two axioms are true of Euler summation and Borel summation. It doesn't matter whether or not you pull off the first term and then apply Euler or Borel, or you don't. It doesn't make any difference. Okay? So what about axiom number two? Well, axiom number two, what I said at the beginning of this lecture was that addition is clearly not infinitely commutative. Of course, addition is commutative, but not infinitely commutative. Also, addition is not infinitely associative. Addition, of course, is associative. It's finitely associative, but it may not be infinitely associative. All right? However, I would like addition to be linear. I would like to keep the property of linearity. So what I would like to require is that if I take the sum of a series of the form okay, if I apply my summation machine to a series of this form, I would like to get, by linearity, by the requirement of linearity, which we call distributivity in arithmetic, the distributive rule, I would like to get alpha times the summation of a sub n plus beta times the summation, beta times the summation of b sub n. Okay, I would like to get the same answer. Okay? All right. So now let's play a game. The game, yes.
You're not using commutativity here?
Positively not.
Well, so let's say you take A1 plus B1.
Yes.
And then you have A2 plus B2.
Right, I'm not changing the order.
But here you have the sum, but here it's A1 plus A2 plus A3 plus A4 or whatever. And then B1 plus B2.
So yeah, yeah. So I'm not so I'm not combining the nth term with the n plus first term. And I'm not adding the n plus first term before the nth term. I'm processing the nth term in the series. I'm not pushing a term forward or backward in a series or associating two different terms of the series. I'm saying that for the nth term only, if it has this form, I can rewrite it in this form. I'm being very careful not to commute and not to associate. Associate means to combine the nth term with the n plus first term, or maybe the nth term with the 2nth term, which we would never want to do. Okay? And I'm not trying, so I'm trying to be very careful about that. And I'm not adding up in a different order. First, I write down the first term, and then the second term, and the third term in that order. I'm not changing the order in which I add the terms.
Okay? But an and bn are both part of the nth term. So now
Yes, of course.
Now you're summing up only part of each term. And
that's right.
And then summing the other part of each term.
That's right.
That's okay?
That's right, sure. So I'm summing up this. And I'm summing up, I'm breaking up the two series into, I'm breaking up one series into two series by the property of linearity.
Okay?
So now let's suppose, hang on for a second. So let's suppose that I have invented a summation machine with these properties. Okay, now of course Euler already did invent one such summation machine, and Borel invented one such summation machine. Now it's my turn, so I'm going to invent a summation machine. But I'm not as smart as they are. So in fact, I'm not going to tell you what I did. But I claim I did it. Okay, I had it last night in a dream. Okay, so we will imagine that we have invented a summation machine with these properties. But we will leave the actual machine unspecified. Okay, I mean, you know, Euler says you multiply by x to the n, you sum the series, take a limit, that's a procedure. Borel says that you write one is some funny way, and then you do an integral, blah, blah, blah. That's a procedure. So I'm not going to tell you my procedure, but I assure you that it's almost as smart as Borel's or Euler's, okay? And now I will apply my summation machine to the series 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 1. Okay? And I claim that if I apply my machine to the series, I will get an answer which I will call S, the sum of the series. Okay? Now, you don't know what my summation machine is, but it satisfies axiom 1 and axiom 2. And therefore, by axiom 1, it is equal to 1 plus the summation machine applied to the remaining terms in the series, which is minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, and so on. Okay? Now, so this is by axiom 1. Okay. Now, by axiom 2, which is linearity, I can rewrite this as 1 plus the summation machine applied to 1. Or sorry, 1 minus the summation machine applied to 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1, and so on. Now, if my summation machine produces the sum S, then S satisfies the equation 1 minus S. Here. S is equal to 1 minus S. And therefore, 2S equals 1, and S equals 1 half. And that's the sum of the series. So why is it that Euler gave the answer 1 half, and Borel gave the answer 1 half? Why did they both give the answer 1 half? Because they had to. Because any summation machine that satisfies these axioms naturally produces the answer 1 half. So the answer 1 half is very meaningful because any summation machine that obeys these reasonable axioms will give you the answer 1 half. That's why it works. Okay? So let's do another example, which I think will sort of illustrate this. Okay. Yeah.
I was just wondering, are we being so careful about addition and not like the associated commutativity of addition? But we are being fairly cavalier about multiplication. We are multiplying infinite numbers by.
Yes, that's what I mean by linearity.
But why is multiplication inherently commutative and associative?
We are making that assumption. Okay, so we are. That's why I'm calling these axioms here. Okay, I mean, we can call this axiom 1, because I can't answer your question. That is to say, there are some summation procedures which do not obey these axioms, and that physicists like. One such summation procedure is called zeta summation, which does not obey these two axioms, and will give different answers. That is, you can invent a summation machine which does not, which evades or which violates these two axioms, or one of these two axioms, okay? And if you use that procedure, you may get, indeed, a different answer. But for the moment, let's require these two axioms, because I think they're very sensible. I think this axiom here, the axiom of linearity, is a very powerful and very significant axiom. I don't want it to be true that if I multiply all the terms in the series by 2, I get a completely different answer. That is, I want it to be that if I multiply every term in the series by 2, that the answer is twice as big. I really want that. Okay? But it isn't obvious that that's true, and I agree with you. It isn't obvious. Okay, so let's take, as a peculiar example, let's take the series 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1, and so on. Let's, just for fun, take this series and ask, what is the sum of that series? Now, you understand that if you could use the associative rule, you could associate these two numbers, these two numbers, these two numbers, and you would get the previous series 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 1, whose sum, we agreed, is 1 half. But we're not going to do that. Okay? We're not going to allow for associate. We're not going to infinitely associate numbers in the series. Okay? Furthermore, we could go further if we could associate numbers in the series. We could associate these three numbers, these three numbers, these three numbers, and then the series would be 0 plus 0 plus 0, whose sum is 0. Okay, so we're not going to do that. We're not going to attempt to do that. Okay, but let's ask, what is the Euler sum? Let's find out quickly what the sum of the series. So what does Mr. Euler tell us? He says, multiply the nth term in the series by x to the n. So that means here we have 1, and then this term would be minus x squared plus x cubed minus x to the fifth plus x to the sixth, 1, ta-da, 2, fifth plus 6, and so on, like that. Okay? So Mr. Euler would say, so long as x is less than 1, this series is a Taylor series. And this series is absolutely convergent. And therefore, we can add up the terms out of order. There's no problem in a Taylor series because it's rapidly convergent. It's absolutely convergent. So we can add up the terms in any order. And in particular, I'm first going to add up all the positive terms, 1 plus x cubed plus x to the 6 plus and so on. And then I'm going to add up all the negative terms, which is minus x squared times 1 plus x cubed plus x to the 6 and so on. OK? Now, the sum of what is the sum of this series? It's a geometric series, so 1 over 1 minus x cubed. And this is x squared times 1 over 1 minus x cubed, which is equal to 1 minus x squared over 1 minus x cubed. Now, what Mr. Euler says is we have to take the limit as x approaches 1. And you notice that as x approaches 1, the denominator is 0, and the numerator is 0. And this is one of the interesting cases. This is very interesting. And I can do one of two things. I can use L'Hopital's rule, or I can simply factor out 1 minus x from the numerator and the denominator. Do whatever you prefer to do. If you'd like, L'Hopital's rule is obvious here. So let's factor. The numerator becomes 1 plus x. The denominator becomes 1 plus x squared. And now we take the limit as x approaches 1, and we get 2/3. OK? So the sum of this series is 2/3. Now, that's what Euler says. Is this meaningful? So let's see. Let's use our summation machine. Because the question is that really the generic sum of the series? Did he get 2/3 just because this was some sort of peculiarity of his technique? The answer is no. He had to get 2/3. Okay? He had to, it had to give the answer 2/3. Let's see if that's true. Okay? So if you take this series and you apply the summation machine to it, we'll say that we will imagine that it produces a sum, some number, called the sum of the series. And we will apply the summation machine to the series 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1, and so on. OK? Now, by axiom number 1, the addition axiom, okay, this is equal to 1 plus the summation machine applied to 0 minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1, and so on. OK? Do you agree? And by the way, we can apply axiom 1 again. Let's apply axiom 1 one more time. That would be, so I'm going to pull out the zeroth term here. And that gives me 1 plus the summation machine applied to minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 1 plus 0 minus 1 and so on. Okay? And all of these are supposed to produce the sum of the series. So now, what am I going to do? I'm going to add it up. That's right. So all I have used axiom number 1 here, and I've used axiom number 1 again, but now I'm going to use axiom number 2. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add this to this to this. Okay? And if I do that, I get 3s is equal to, when I add up the 1 and the 1, I get 2, plus the summation machine applied to, now I have to be very careful, as I said before, I'm not interchanging, I'm not adding the nth term to the n plus first term, I'm not using associativity or commutivity, I'm looking at the first term in this series, and I'm allowed to add it up. And when I add up those three numbers, I get 0. And when I add up the next three numbers, I get 0. And when I add up the next three numbers, I get 0 and 0 and 0. OK? And now I have to apply the summation machine to 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0. OK? And now it's clear that my partial sums are converging. That is, I repeatedly, so this is one of the rare cases where the answer to your question is, yes, it works. It's converging, OK? So I repeatedly use axiom 1. And this series, 0 plus 0 plus 0, adds up to 0. All this is 0. And I have the equation 3s equals 2. And so therefore, s is equal to 2/3. And that's the answer, OK? So why is it that Euler gave us the answer 2/3? Because it had to give 2/3. Because Euler's summation procedure satisfies axiom number 1 and axiom number 2. It had to give that answer. It didn't have any choice. And without even looking at it, I know that Borel, even if it's a mess, has to give the answer 2/3. It has no choice. Yeah?
Can we just use this axioms to and not actually commit to any machine?
Exactly. That's my point. So what we have here is a generic summation procedure. So before we quit, let's sum two interesting series. Just two, OK? So let's sum the following series. I think a particularly interesting series to sum might be 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8. OK? So let's ask, what is the sum of that series? Or to ask it, what I'm saying is there a meaningful way to sum that series? OK? Is there a meaningful way? So what do? We apply the summation machine to the series, and we hope that the summation machine will produce an answer. Now, it could be that the summation machine is not powerful enough to produce an answer. It might not be powerful. It might be that we apply the summation machine, and the best it can say is either the answer is ambiguous, or that is, it doesn't produce an answer, or it might tell us the answer is infinity, which is perfectly, well, it seems reasonable. But let's see what we get. OK, so first, I apply axiom number 1, which seems like a reasonable thing to do. So that says that the sum is equal to, I just pull out the first term in the series, 1, plus the summation machine applied to 2 plus 4 plus 8 plus 16, and so on. OK? Now I will use axiom number 2, linearity. I notice that every single term in this series contains a factor of 2, and therefore the sum is equal to 1 plus the summation machine of 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8 and so on, times 2, okay, times 2, okay? But we have assumed that the summation machine gives the sum s, and therefore s is equal to 1 plus 2s, and therefore s is equal to minus 1. That's the sum of the series, minus 1. Now, the first thing you may think is, hang on, you might say, just a moment, how could it be that the sum of a bunch of positive terms could ever be a negative number? And my answer to you is, why not? Okay? If you want to know a simple way of thinking about it, you can imagine this. You can say, here is the real axis, okay? And you can map, I can map onto the real axis just using, you know, I can map the points on a circle onto the real axis, and you know the technique. You just take a line from the center of a circle that passes through the circle and hits the real axis. Okay, so I have a one-to-one correspondence between every point on the real axis and every point on the circle. Okay? So, or I can take a line from the North Pole, if you like, and I can just assign every, okay? Sorry? Sure, sure. This will be one-to-one. So just starting at the North Pole, for example, I can draw, this is just a Mercator projection, right? So for every point on the circle, there corresponds a point on the real axis. Okay? So this is a mapping from the circumference of a circle, which is of finite length, onto the line of infinite length. But this is no surprise to you. You can map from a finite interval to an infinite interval in a one-to-one fashion. Right? Okay. All right, so what is happening here is that if you ask, what is, you know, as we add more and more points, 1, 2, 4, 8, in some sense, what is happening is that the partial sums are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And in some sense, we're moving around the circle. And what has happened is that we have moved around the circle and converged to some point over here, which, when you look at the Mercator projection, corresponds to minus 1. So you can think of it that way. If it bothers you that you're adding up a bunch of positive numbers and getting a negative answer, is that silly or stupid? Well, you're going by what you learned in finite arithmetic. Finite arithmetic is associative, it's commutative, it has all the properties that my elementary school taught me. Okay. And one such property is that if you add two positive numbers, you get a positive number. And if you add two negative numbers, you get a negative number. Okay? But if you do it an infinite number of times, is that still true? No, it's not. It's not still true. So one of the things you have to give up with arithmetic when you deal with divergent series is that it's not obvious that the sum of a bunch of positive numbers is positive. Okay, last point, very last point, and that is this. The last point is, what is the sum of the series 1 plus 1 plus 1? Okay? You might ask, what is the sum of that simple series? Okay? So I will apply my summation machine, and if my summation machine works, it will produce an answer called S. Now you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to use axiom number 1, which says that this is equal to, just pull off the first term in the series, axiom number 1. That gives me 1 plus the summation machine applied to 1 plus 1 plus 1. Okay? Which, by assumption, is S. Okay? And therefore S obeys the equation S is equal to 1 plus S. Okay? And the solution to this equation, of course, is infinity. There's only one solution to that equation, S equals infinity. And the question is, Is that bad? No, it's not bad. That's the answer to that. So that particular series has the generic sum infinity. In some sense, it's a relief to know that some divergent series are really equal to infinity. Okay, that is to say, when you sum all of these points, okay, you wind up right at the North Pole. And the North Pole corresponds to the point at infinity, both plus infinity and minus infinity. In fact, that's the one place where this Mercator mapping is not really one-to-one in some sense, because from the North Pole, you can either go to plus infinity or minus infinity. And the sum of that series, according to us, by this sort of generic summation procedure, we claim that the sum of 1 plus 1 plus 1 is really infinity. Now, I think the question, I bet you the question you're going to ask is, well, go ahead. You should. So, I bet I know what you're going to ask.
You keep talking about this limiting procedure on the Riemann sphere.
Yeah.
Is that, can you actually define that, and does it correspond to a summation machine?
Well, here I'm sort of being sloppy. But presumably, we could invent a summation machine that really does that. We would have to be very careful in how we designed it, because we want to make sure that it satisfies those two axioms. Okay? We really want to be very, very careful. We want to make sure that it satisfies linearity. And this mapping is a tricky mapping because it involves sines of angles and stuff like that, right? So we have to be very careful. But it's clear that we can define a mapping from the infinite real axis onto a finite, finite length, finite set, okay, compact set, and we can arrange it so that these two axioms are satisfied. We can do such a thing, okay. I don't know whether or not the Mercator mapping would do that, so I'm being a little bit sloppy here, but I assume that we could do that.
But right. I can't look at, for example, 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8 on the Riemann sphere and see that it converges.
It's not obvious, no. And so we have to see what the mapping really looks like. It's not obvious. You can't see that. Okay. But what I was arguing was simply that, you know, if you're walking around the Riemann sphere, nothing special happens when you pass the North Pole. It's not as if you suddenly, you know, when you see a positive number becoming a negative number, you visualize this is a big transition that has occurred, right? But when you're walking around the sphere, there isn't a bump or a jump or a discontinuity here at the North Pole. You just keep going smoothly. And positive numbers and negative numbers are just sort of smooth continuations of one another. And this is the nature of the point at infinity. That's the nature. It is, in fact, the Riemann sphere that people use to argue in the theory of complex variables that the point at infinity is just one other complex number, just like all the other complex numbers. And the point, when you include the point at infinity, that closes the complex plane. The complex plane is closed, not open, but closed, because it includes the point at infinity, which is the North Pole. Okay, that's the point.
You do lose your scaling properties when you do that, though, right?
I'm sorry, I lose my...
You lose the fact that the complex numbers are a field?
Yes. Okay. Are a field? Oh, we'll get it. We can talk. Yeah.
It seems that this interpretation, though, is at least slightly problematic if we consider instead of 2 to the n, a to the n, mm-hmm. because then we get, you know, for a not equal to 1 there, where we've seen this degenerate, but we get mm-hmm. that s is equal to negative a plus 1.
Yeah.
So right. But so I mean, as we sum larger numbers, we get more negative.
Right, right. And so, it, all I can say is, the result of summing a series, it's not obvious. In other words,
right.
It's very bad. No, you're absolutely right. It gets more negative, and so this is very strange. Okay, and all I can say is that. The sense of that when we try to assign a sum to a series, it's not obvious. So the notion of bigger or smaller begins to get a little fuzzy, more than a little bit fuzzy.
Well, okay? That's why I specifically use the word more negative.
Yeah. But let's go back But before we quit, let me just answer your question, okay? Because this is actually, you're raising not that issue, but you're raising a more important general issue, and that is this. This is the scenario. Okay, this is, I've only talked about mathematics today, and I haven't talked about physics. Okay, so the scenario is this. Somebody gives you a hard problem. That person could well be your thesis advisor. You never know. Okay, and you're working on a problem, and you decide to take this very hard problem and to reduce it to a finite number of solvable problems. The only thing that does that for you is perturbation. Okay? You then reduce the answer to a perturbation series which needs to be summed. And you discover, except for a set of measure zero of the time, that that perturbation series has a zero radius of convergence. There's absolutely no reason for that series to converge. In fact, any sum of Feynman diagrams is going to be a divergent series. Okay? Now you have to assign a sum to that series in a sensible and meaningful way. So I claim that the answer you're going to get is not only unique in the sense, you know, if you apply these axioms here, you're going to get a unique answer. But I claim that the answer is meaningful. That is to say, if we were finding the eigenvalues of the anharmonic oscillator or solving a physical problem and finding, you know, like G minus 2 for an electron, for example, okay, the anomalous magnetic moment for an electron, or some physical quantity. I claim that although the series representing that physical quantity is divergent, there is a unique sum to that series. And that sum is actually the answer you would get by solving the problem numerically, or solving it on a lattice, or solving it some other way, or just measuring it in the laboratory. That's the answer you get. And that's the part, that's what we're going to be talking about for the rest of this week. And that is the remarkable thing, that this is not just fun and games, but this is actually meaningful. Okay? And this is the reason that's basically never taught when you learn quantum mechanics. This is the reason that we can use perturbation theory. Okay? This is the underlying reason that we can even learn perturbation theory. Knowing that perturbation theory gives a divergent series, you might as well stop there, unless you can sum a divergent series. Okay? So, yeah.
What happens if you try to sum the harmonic series? Can we get something?
That is infinity.
That's infinity.
That really is infinity. So the harmonic series, so it was really true that if you try to build an overhang, okay, it's really true. Architects can rely on this. The overhang really is infinitely long. Okay, you could build a bridge that goes infinitely far without falling down. Okay, it's really true. That, so, in fact, there are several series that really do add up to infinity. One such series is 1 plus 1 plus 1, although zeta function summation will not give you 1 plus 1 plus 1 is infinity. It'll give you a finite number, minus a half. The sum of this series, using a different technique, modal summation, zeta summation, will be minus one half. We'll talk about that. Okay. But the harmonic series is truly infinity. It is truly infinity. And that's a perfectly good answer. There's nothing wrong with the fact that the sum of 1 over n is infinity. It really is infinity. Yeah. Okay, you are absolutely right, and you have just, I have to thank you for that, because that was a really good question. It was a really, really good question, and I have to thank you for that, because in a sense, what you've done is you've just given me the introduction for tomorrow's lecture, okay? The point is this. In real life, everything I've been telling you about here is not really doable. That is, it's doable in principle, but it's not really doable, and that's because we don't have an infinite number of terms in the series. In order to calculate these sums that these calculations here, concluding that it's minus one, we had to know all the terms in the series. Okay, if we didn't know all the terms in the series, we were stuck. So we have to invent, in some sense, an even better summation machine where, as input, we only use a finite number of terms in the series. Because we don't have an infinite number of terms. Okay? That is, you can only sum one loop Feynman diagrams, two loops, three loops, four loops, and then you get tired. Okay? Because it took you 4 years to do the four loops. Okay? And typically, when you're summing Feynman diagrams, each new term in the sum is n factorial more difficult. The difficulty grows like n, so that is summing Feynman diagrams having four vertices is four times harder, typically. It may even be four squared times harder than doing Feynman diagrams having three vertices. And Feynman diagrams having five vertices is five times harder than the previous one. So the difficulty grows like a factorial. Okay? So it's absolutely true that you cannot go infinitely far. And so the question we have to ask now is a much harder question and a much more interesting question. Given a finite number of terms in the series, what's the best sum of the series? What's the best estimate you can make of the sum? And this is a deep, deep question. We're going to be discussing this. Okay, that's the point of the rest of this course. Okay, and just to summarize the answer is not known in any unique sense. That is, I will show you a lot of procedures, but there is no, the very best procedure is not known. And this is a deep, deep problem in information theory. That is, how do you extract in the most efficient possible way the sum of the series from just the first few terms in the series? Okay? This is a really deep question. This is a fantastically interesting question. That is, you know, the first few terms in a series know a lot about the sum of the series. This is what you learned when you did Shanks and Richardson. The first few terms do know a lot. But did you extract the maximum amount of information? Okay? How do you get the most out of what you've been able to calculate in perturbation theory? And that is not a known, this answer is not known. It's very interesting. Yeah?
How come there's no notion of one series being bigger than another series?
The reason, the deep reason, is that in fact what we're doing is really, I've been hiding it from you, but what we've been doing is really happening in the complex plane. And in the complex, although I only did it on the real axis, this is really sort of a projection of something is going on in the complex plane that is telling us what is going on. The singularities in the complex plane are determining what is going on in the sum of the series. Okay, that's typically what happens. And in the complex plane, there is no ordering relation. You cannot say the complex number Z1 is bigger than Z2 or smaller than Z2. When you extend from the real numbers to the complex numbers, which is what is happening underlying all of this, is the complex plane, you lose an ordering relation. Okay? You give that up. So the algebra of complex numbers, you cannot say these complex numbers are bigger than those. And so that's the reason why, in fact, you asked me earlier, you know, if I sum, instead of the sum of 2 to the n, if I sum 3 to the n, you have this funny ordering relation that it's more negative even though the 3s are bigger, that kind of thing. That's because what is happening in the complex plane, and we don't have an ordering relation. We have to give that up. And so the notion of greater than or less than, that is a property only of the real numbers. And in order to invent these summation machines, we are using the complex numbers. You haven't seen it yet, but in fact what is happening is we have cuts in the complex plane, and we're calculating the discontinuities across the cut, and so on. We're going to see this, okay? We're going to talk about Herglotz functions and stuff. I think we better stop now because we're running into... Okay.